What we found out was the conventional wisdom was wrong.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson.
He says, if you team don't think you're up to this challenge, let me know. I'll find people who are. I had a wife and four kids. I said, we can do it, boss.
I mean, the sense of power of 100 of those huge cars, each carrying 30,000 gallons of crude oil, whizzing by me. I was scared.
I'm standing on the Magnolia Bridge, looking down as men in yellow coats are trying to get a derailed oil train back on track here.
That's coming up on Reveal.
There's something coming.
Reveal is supported by Casper, who delivers an obsessively engineered mattress at a very fair price. In fact, Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that on to the customer. They offer a risk-free trial and return policy. Try sleeping on a Casper for 100 days with free delivery and painless returns. It's an American-made mattress, starting from $500 for a twin and $950 for a king. Reveal listeners get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/reveal and using promo code REVEAL at checkout.
Last week, we looked at the energy boom in the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota. Today, we're going to dig deeper into energy production in the U.S. with a story about oil train spotters. But first, we've been talking about the use of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, to get natural gas and oil out of the ground. And if fracking has a rock star, it's this man.
We knew the gas was there. We didn't know how to get it free.
That's George Mitchell, and most people in the energy business call him the father of fracking. Mitchell passed away in 2013 at the age of 94. But Scott Tong, sustainability correspondent for Marketplace, did a rare interview with Mitchell a few months before his death.
So George Mitchell is a fascinating story. The son of Greek immigrants. Early on, he worked for Amoco, one of the big companies. And then he started his own company with his brother. And this is a branch of the industry called the independents. In the 60s and 70s, the major started focusing on oil. They walked away from the natural gas space, and that became the space for independent oilmen.
Guys like George Mitchell. But as it turns out, back in the early 80s, Mitchell had a problem. He made promises to his clients that he knew he couldn't keep.
Well, in the early 80s, Mitchell pulled his guys into a room and said, we have a situation here. We have a contract to sell natural gas for a long period of time, and right now, we only have 10 years of it. You got 10 years to find a new technology to find me some more natural gas.
Dan Stewart was one of the geologists who worked for Mitchell, and he remembers that time well.
He says, if you team don't think you're up to this challenge, let me know. I'll find people who are. I had a wife and four kids. I said, we can do it, boss.
Mitchell was convinced that he could extract natural gas from shale, a type of sedimentary rock, and he bet on an existing technology that engineers had been struggling to perfect for years, fracking.
They figured it out with a whole lot of trial and error. What they needed to do was to make these cracks underground by sending a fluid down at great pressure to break the rock. So the question was, what fluid were they going to use? They tried a whole bunch of gels and thickening agents to try to create cracks in the rock and to kind of keep them open.
But that wasn't working very well. Kent Bowker was one of the petroleum geologists who worked on the project. Now, George Mitchell was a famous tightwad, which was a part of the challenge.
The idea was, we need to try something that will save us some money. So let's try this water frack or slick water frack. And when he did that, it cost about half as much. But what we found out was, the conventional wisdom was wrong. We want low viscosity fluid, just water.
Once the engineers had fracking technology working for them, their boss placed another unlikely bet. Mitchell told his geologist to map something called the Barnett Shale, a geological formation below Fort Worth, Texas, one that other energy companies had written off.
What we showed was there is almost four times more gas in this rock than we originally thought. I can remember vividly, going over exactly what this means. And Mr. Mitchell got this big smile on his face. We are at a big conference table. He leans forward and he looks at all of us. This is huge. This is the biggest thing that's ever happened to this company. It's also the biggest secret No one can talk about this.
Using fracking to unleash natural gas in the Barnett Shale was a gusher of an idea. It made Mitchell a billionaire and changed the landscape of energy production in America. Remember, Mitchell started his work back in the 70s and 80s when the U.S. was running out of oil and natural gas and the economy was a mess. So this was a big deal. Dan Stewart was one of the geologists who worked for Mitchell, and these guys were trying to be the saviors of the American economy. So they saw fracking in almost religious terms.
It is easy for me to say this is a gift from God. George Mitchell isn't God, but George Mitchell started acting right when it needed to happen. The Barnett gas is important, but it is not near as important as the technology and the understanding it created.
America's energy landscape has changed a lot in just 10 years, in part because of George Mitchell's vision. Thanks to Reveal producer Jillian Weinberger and to Scott Tong and Marketplace for providing us with sound for that story. You can watch a short animated explainer on how fracking works at revealnews.org. Since 2006, fracking has opened up huge new reservoirs of energy in the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota. We explored that issue last week on the podcast. If you haven't heard it, check it out. But without a developed pipeline infrastructure, there aren't a lot of ways to ship oil out of the state, which brings us to trains. That sound interrupts our meetings all the time here in our offices in Emeryville, California. We're right near the foot of the Bay Bridge, and there are train tracks that run right next to our building. And if you think that's bad, listen to this. Now, I'm standing outside right next to the train tracks. And while the noise is distracting, some people are much more concerned about what's being carried by the trains. The long lines of black pill-shaped cars carry all sorts of stuff. Ethanol, various chemicals, and now there's a proposal to transport oil from North Dakota to a refinery in Central California, right down this rail line. These days, there's a lot more of this type of crude rolling through the country than just a few years ago, 40 times more than in 2008. But a lot of locals aren't crazy about the idea. Here's why. This type of oil, the stuff at the center of America's energy boom, contains high concentrations of toxic and volatile gases. It's the most dangerous crude on the rails. Just this year, 5 oil trains have derailed and caught fire. Emergency responders say they need more information from railroads and oil companies so they can be ready for the worst, but they're having to fight for that information. Ashley Ahern from member station KUOW in Seattle and the public media collaborative EarthFix has a story about crusaders who aren't taking no for an answer.
It's not every Tuesday night that you get to spend sitting in a car with a complete stranger counting trains. But that's what I'm doing with Dean Smith.
And I like to park right here when I'm watching trains because I can see the bridge up here and I can see the tracks down below.
About a year ago, Dean began noticing those mile-long oil trains coming through town, and it frightened him. Washington is one of the biggest oil refining states in the country, with 1.5 million barrels arriving here each week.
I was sitting here once and an oil train came through, and I did walk up right next to it. And I mean, this sense of power of 100 of those huge cars, each carrying 30,000 gallons of crude oil, whizzing by me. I was scared.
Dean tells me he's worried that one of those trains could catch fire or explode in his community, just like what happened 2 years ago in rural Quebec. 47 people were killed, and most of a small town was burned to the ground. But when Dean tried to learn more about the trains, what routes they were taking, how many of them there were, what kind of oil they were carrying, local officials told him they didn't have that information. So Dean decided to find out himself. He organized 30 volunteers to take shifts, counting trains around the clock for a week straight. That's what we're doing tonight.
It's a passenger train, and it's northbound. And that's all I need.
All the volunteers upload their train sightings into a website Dean made. There are small placards on the train cars with numbers on them, It's a code for what the train's carrying.
So I hit send, and it sent my data to the database. So now it's recorded. That's what I'm here for. Data.
Dean's retired now, but he was a college student back in the days of Sputnik and the Cold War. He double majored in math and physics, which led to an interesting career with the National Security Agency.
The work that I was doing there was all top secret. It involved going somewhere in the world and collecting some data and analyzing it about some Soviet activities. Enough said. So, I mean, this counting trains is pretty pedestrian. But you know, it's simple and it's profound in a way. If you can show relationships that can't be denied, then you can make some progress. I learned that at NSA.
I contacted the NSA to verify that Dean worked there. A spokesperson told me the NSA doesn't confirm what it calls agency affiliation. Dean and I listen to the rain on the roof of the car and wait for an oil train. No sign of one yet, but Dean is a patient and persistent man. Last year, when he started the train watch, Dean was able to gather more information about oil train traffic in 1 week than the railroads had given the state in the 3 years oil trains have been coming here. And that information is really important. Dave Byers is the head of oil spill response for the Washington State Department of Ecology.
It gives us an idea of what to prepare for, what the risk is, the routes that are taken.
And there have been some close calls already. One morning last July, I woke up and checked the news on my phone like I do every morning. And I saw that an oil train had derailed right here in Seattle at 1:50 a.m. I jumped on my motorcycle and raced down to the scene. Here's the story I filed for KUOW.
I'm standing on the Magnolia Bridge, looking down as men in yellow coats are trying to get a derailed oil train back on track here. It looks like there's at least one train car slightly off kilter on the track, and they're moving along the track with an orange or yellow tractor trying to put each one back on there.
Seattle was lucky that morning. The three train cars that derailed weren't punctured and no oil was spilled. But Dave Byers says that the company, BNSF Railway, didn't handle the situation properly. BNSF notified Dave Byers and his team almost an hour and a half after the derailment.
And the dispatcher from the rail company told our responder that there had been a derailment and there were no hazardous materials involved and there was no potential for hazardous materials to be involved.
Byers' team wasn't told there was volatile crude oil in that train until 5 hours after the derailment. And it was the oil refinery that told them, not BNSF Railway.
So we immediately sent responders down there to assess the situation. When we arrived, we didn't find a BNSF representative on scene.
But Byers' team did see workers welding on damaged oil cars. When asked, the workers said they didn't know what was in the cars. The area wasn't fenced off from the public. And North Dakota crude can catch fire and explode at temperatures as low as 74 degrees Fahrenheit.
We became concerned because people were wandering off the street and taking selfies of themselves next to the rail cars. And there was no preparing for the potential that one of those cars could actually start leaking.
There were people welding on cars full of oil that has a flash point of 74 degrees?
Yes.
Earlier this year, state regulators recommended that BNSF Railway be fined up to $700,000 for failing to quickly report spills of hazardous materials. The company is appealing, and a decision is expected next year. I contacted BNSF Railway about the Seattle derailment. Spokeswoman Courtney Wallace emailed a response. She said BNSF had its hazardous materials team in place quickly to evaluate the situation, and that, quote, this derailment did not cause a release at any point, nor was there a threat of a release. Communities along the railroad tracks are worried. This spring, several hundred people packed into the Anacortes City Hall to get information from oil companies and BNSF Railway. Anacortes is north of Seattle on the coast. There are two refineries here that receive oil by rail from North Dakota.
I want to thank you guys for coming today. This is obviously a very important issue to our community. And
just that morning, a BNSF oil train had derailed and caught fire in North Dakota. No one in the audience was allowed to talk. They could just submit written questions. The oil refineries talked about the safety precautions they have at their facilities to prevent a spill. They talked about their commitment to getting newer oil train cars. Courtney Wallace, the spokeswoman with BNSF Railway, was there. She talked about the company's commitment to safety. She said that BNSF believes that every accident is preventable. I walked over to her after the event.
Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah.
So can you tell me how much information is the railroad sharing right now with first responders?
We have always provided information to first responders, emergency managers, about historically what has moved through their towns. And so we're always cognizant of what information is shared because we don't want to see an incident happen that involves terrorism or anyone else who might have that kind of frame of mind.
BNSF Railway has said that information about oil train movements is proprietary, and sharing it could put the company at a competitive disadvantage. It took a federal emergency order to force BNSF to share oil train traffic information with states. Washington State is going one step further. The legislature just passed a new law that requires more detailed information about oil train traffic. It forces the refineries to share that information, since the state doesn't have the authority to get it from the railroads. They're regulated federally.
We're going to learn, I think, how much we don't know by having some of this information, and we may find that there's gaps and we need to do more.
Jessen Farrell is a state representative from Seattle and a Democrat. She was the lead author of the new legislation. I met up with her at a local park.
We're going to get the information. I don't really care who gives it to us as long as it's good information and it stands in court because we need that information now.
Farrell's bill passed with bipartisan support after a long fight and heavy lobbying from the oil industry and the railroad. But Dean Smith, the train watcher near Seattle, says that no matter how hard the railroad fights the new law, it's pretty hard to hide an oil train. At this point in his shift, we've been waiting for 4 hours by the tracks north of Seattle. Still, no oil train. The streetlight reflects off Dean's glasses in the dark, and I can see the shadows gathered in the furrow of his brow. And then...
there's something coming. Yeah.
The orange BNSF engine emerges from the tunnel, and then the black, pill-shaped oil cars, one after another. The minutes tick by, car after car after car. I watch Dean Smith, standing in the rain, shoulders hunched.
Sometimes I wonder why fight it. Why not just move? That'd be the easy thing to do. But I think we have to fight. And I would like to see citizens' groups acting like this all over the country. That's a form of checks and balances that we can create. All it takes is a few people.
Ashley Ahern is a reporter for EarthFix, a public media collaboration that covers science, energy, and the environment in the Pacific Northwest. She's based at KUOW in Seattle. The oil industry in Washington State wants to build 5 new terminals to move crude oil off of trains and onto ships. Meanwhile, Congress is considering a law that would lift the federal ban on exporting crude oil that's been in place since the early 70s, allowing American crude to be shipped around the world. And that could mean a lot more oil trains coming from North Dakota. Thanks for listening. We've got another podcast coming your way next Tuesday. We'll be going to Oklahoma, where earthquakes are the wave of the future. As always, we want to know what you think. Tweet us at Reveal or find us on Facebook. Leave us a review on iTunes. It makes a big difference and helps new listeners find us. And remember, we're also on the air. Check with your public radio station to see what time they're airing us. And if they're not, let them know you'd like to hear us. This episode was edited by Taki Telenitas. Our lead sound designer and engineer is my man, Mr. J. Breezy, Jim Briggs. Our editorial director is Robert Saliday, and our managing director is Krista Scharfenberg. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music today was from Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation and the Ford Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story.